It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. You know, there's a famous moment in New York City history. It happened to be about baseball, but that's beside the point. It was the last game of the season in 1951 when either the Brooklyn Dodgers or the New York Giants would go to the World Series, right? The game ends when a Giants player named Bobby Thompson hits a home run that became known as the shot heard round the world. And the excited Giants radio announcer, a guy named Russ Hodges, starts shouting and repeating, "The Giants win the pennant! The Giants win the pennant!" Yeah, like that. Well, that's kind of what happened with some Democrats on Saturday night when the word came down that the Nevada Senate race had been called for Catherine Cortez Masto, which meant the Democrats retain their United States Senate majority. Some Democrats I know started calling and texting each other to say, "The Democrats won the Senate. The Democrats won the Senate." And there it was after 9 o'clock on Saturday night, when not that many people are thinking about politics, right? But words started getting out, and Democrats were texting and tweeting and calling each other, "The Democrats win the Senate! The Democrats win the Senate!" Yeah, kind of like that. But all the cheering was disaggregated on social media. If they were watching one of the Democrats' favorite TV channels, MSNBC, they saw it happen in real time. Their elections analyst, Steve Kornacki, was talking about the state of the Nevada race when all of a sudden...
There it is. That's the check mark.
Oh, wow.
Catherine Cortez Masto declared by our decision desk the winner of the Nevada Senate race. With Catherine Cortez Masto's victory in the Nevada Senate race, Democrats now have control of the United States Senate ensured. They have their 50 seats, with Kamala Harris casting the tie-breaking vote that guarantees Democratic control of the Senate for the next 2 years.
So there it was. And in a midterm election that was supposed to favor the party out of power, the Democrats kept control and may even add one seat compared to before, depending on how the Georgia runoff comes out on December 6th. So let's talk about it with Time Magazine political correspondent, national politics correspondent, Molly Ball. Hi, Molly. Thanks for coming on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
And listeners, are you a Democrat who started calling or texting or tweeting people on Saturday night, "The Democrats win the Senate, the Democrats win the..." How did that go for you? Or any questions or comments from any side of the aisle, from Molly Ball from Time, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. Molly, can we start with Nevada in particular? Then we'll go on to what might happen in the Senate as a result of these elections. How did Catherine Cortez Masto hang on to her seat in a year when the Republicans were trying hard to win over Latinos in the big Las Vegas area and had a shot at flipping that seat?
Yeah, you know, and I was a reporter in Nevada myself for several years and went out there to cover this race. And it was really a microcosm of all of the national forces that I think we saw at play across the map that brought us to this scenario where, as you said, the Democrats kept the Senate and could even add to their number of seats, depending on how Georgia goes. So, you know, out in Nevada, there's a lot of economic hardship. People, voters, clearly do not feel like things are going well. They've soured on President Biden, despite him having won the state a couple of years ago. As you said, Republicans made a very strong effort to target the large Latino population. We don't know exactly what role they played in this election yet, but estimated to be about 20% of the vote. And Catherine Cortez Masto herself is the first Latina, only Latina in the Senate. So, you know, she was facing some real headwinds, but she had a few things going for her. Number one, that ability to personally appeal to Hispanics, I think, was important. And the ground game that was backing her up, the so-called Reid machine created by the late Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, that has continued to give the Democrats a strong infrastructure in Nevada. Number two, the abortion issue. She emphasized that a lot. She also talked a lot about democracy and January 6th. Her opponent was an election denier who had really spearheaded Trump's attempts to overturn the 2020 election in the state, and she emphasized that very hard. And I think that was the third thing really going in her favor was her opponent. Her opponent, Adam Laxalt, also a former Nevada attorney general, was a sort of a hard right Trumpist candidate, not a moderate like many successful Nevada Republicans have been over the years. And he did not really try to move to the center. Both candidates refused to debate. And so I think, you know, as we saw in so many races across the map, voters were ready to hypothetically elect a Republican, but not this Republican. They looked at their choices in this election and said, you know, this guy's just too far out there for me, and I'm going to stick with the status quo.
And earlier in the weekend, Democratic Senator Mark Kelly had been declared the winner in his very close reelection battle against a very Trumpy election denier named Blake Masters. Then Cortez Masto held her seat in Nevada against Adam Laxalt, who, as you say, had also embraced the big lie. Nevada and Arizona, two of the ultimate swing states in America right now, and two of the states where the big lie crowd had most focused their accusations. So you say it was partly about that, and maybe some additional evidence that it was meaningfully about that is that on the same day, I think just hours earlier on Saturday, the governor's race in Nevada was called for the Republican, and also the race for Secretary of State there went to a Democrat over an election denier who would have been the administrator of the state's future elections in the role of Secretary of State. So people really seem to split their ballots, at least in Nevada, and the election denial, big lie, democracy aspect seem key.
That's right. And I think you see that in Arizona, too. Nevada and Arizona both had election deniers running for Secretary of State. And the candidate in Nevada, Jim Marchant, was sort of the ringleader of this national group of Republican Secretary of State candidates whose whole proposition to the electorate was, I'm going to steal elections, more or less, right? I'm going to run these elections in a way that makes it impossible for Republicans to lose, more or less. And voters really don't like the idea of politicians taking democracy out of their hands, taking their right to vote and choose their own leaders away from them. So we see, as you said, this ticket splitting going on, this attention being paid to these normally quite sleepy Secretary of State races where voters really noticed what the candidates were talking about in these races that had to do with election administration, you know, and in Arizona too, right? We have that Senate race has already been called. The Secretary of State's race has been called. The governor's race still hanging by a thread between Katie Hobbs and Carrie Lake. And whichever way that goes, that is further evidence of ticket splitting because obviously a lot of voters voted for Mark Kelly, who then may have already also voted for Carrie Lake. And that's why that race continues to be close.
Yeah, though Carrie Lake is such a big election denier that it would go against the trend. It would be an exception to the trend if she were to win. Do you see any election denialism about to rear its head about the Arizona or Nevada Senate results? It doesn't seem to be happening around the country where Republicans lose. But I see Blake Masters says he won't concede, last I saw, and will wait until all the votes are counted. But even that is still sort of within the realm of hardball normal if he doesn't start making stuff up.
That's right. And what we've seen across the country is that these candidates are conceding and things are going in sort of orderly, normal fashion. Even, you know, Doug Mastriano in Pennsylvania has admitted he lost the election. And broadly across the board, almost all of these candidates are conceding the elections that they've lost. As you say, Carrie Lake is sort of a leading proponent of the stolen election claim. So and that race is extremely close. And there were some issues on election day with the administration of it. So we'll see if that turns into some sort of debacle. But I think, you know, what we saw even with Trump was that these are very hard claims to make if you don't have a very strong sort of public backing behind you to sort of give you that megaphone. You can claim you won an election, you won all you you lost all you want, but if nobody cares, it sort of doesn't matter. So I think, you know, democracy won in the larger sense, not just because voters rejected anti-democratic candidates, but because the workings of democracy seem to be a lot healthier than I think a lot of people had feared.
Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time, with us. We'll get to a couple of phone calls at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. But let's turn now to the Senate itself. Does Schumer get any credit for holding the Senate? Does McConnell get any blame?
Yes and yes. I mean, I think we're seeing that already. I think certainly there had not, even prior to this, even when Democrats thought they might lose the Senate, there hadn't really been any rumblings within the Senate Democratic caucus against Leader Schumer. He obviously won his reelection quite easily. And there were some tough results, as I'm sure you've talked about, in New York for the Democrats that have caused a lot of recriminations in state Democratic politics. But you know, I think in the broader sense, you know, Schumer obviously put up with a lot of drama from this 50-50 Senate. You know, things looked good at first with the passage of the American Rescue Plan. And then there was about a year-long stretch where all they did was fight and couldn't get Build Back Better over the line. And then this year, it started to turn around. And there were a number of bipartisan bills passed through the Senate. And so I think that gives Democrats a lot of hope that they can continue to get things done, although it depends a lot on what's going to happen in the House, and we obviously still don't know. In the Senate caucus, it has been quite remarkable to see, because we so rarely have seen any kind of dissent expressed against Mitch McConnell. Trump has been agitating against him for years now, calling him names, urging Republicans to go against him, and it really hasn't happened until now. But, you know, losing really makes people think hard about these things. And we now know that you know, we had seen Rick Scott, the head of the Republican Senate Committee, and McConnell feuding all through this cycle over campaign strategy. Scott now has dropped his potential challenge to McConnell, but you do have a number of Republican senators in the sort of Trumpist wing asking to delay leadership elections until we know the final vote count in the Senate, saying, you know, if Herschel Walker wins that election in Georgia, he should be able to vote in this election instead of having it held this week, which obviously would mean he could not. And so I think there's going to be some interesting turmoil within that caucus. It pales in comparison to what's happening among the House Republicans right now. Mm-hmm. But I do think that you see, you know, some rumblings against McConnell in an interesting way.
So I used an old baseball moment analogy to compare it to Saturday night when the Senate was called for the Democrats. I think Elliot in Manhattanville has an old movie analogy. Elliot, you're on WNYC. Hello.
I do. Thank you, Brian. Yes, the movie analogy about a cultural icon, which you and Molly Ball are both cultural icons yourself. In the film The Godfather, there is a scene in which you can clearly hear Russ Hodges' broadcast of that game playing on a car radio. It's not the famous line. It's somewhere else in the game. Uh-huh. And the scene was filmed in a district on Long Island that is now flipped to the Republicans. The actor who is killed in the scene, or his character is killed, is James Caan, who in 2016 came out for Donald Trump. So
I thought my metaphor was tortured.
I'm not claiming that there's anything straightforward about this, but people will read into it what they will.
Elliot, thank
you
very
much. It's a great
movie,
anyway.
Thank you very much. Certainly that. I know they were playing a Godfather marathon on AMC on Saturday night. Molly, to pick up on what you were saying a minute ago, if McConnell turns out to be out as minority leader, or if he has to fight to retain that position, who compete for that role, and with what agendas for change to try to win the next time, if that's clear at all at this early stage?
It's not clear at this early stage. You know, as I mentioned, Senator Rick Scott from Florida had been prepared to challenge McConnell, but has backed down in the face of these disappointing results. And I think, you know, within that Senate Republican caucus, certainly there are a lot more fingers pointed at Scott than there are at McConnell. And so, you know, no one has proposed to challenge McConnell directly. But you do have, you know, voices like Josh Hawley from Missouri saying there needs to be, you know, some kind of change, that because this has been, you know, a losing strategy, they need to go back to the drawing board and rethink, you know, everything from the sort of first principles of the ideology to campaign strategy and so on. So I think, you know, there may be a lively discussion. Potentially McConnell could even have to make a concession or two. But he's thought to be pretty secure. I think it's more significant just that he has for so long had such tight control over that caucus that any suggestion that that's not the case is going to make it harder, you know, for him to participate in negotiations and participate in governing going forward.
Listener tweets, if it stays 50-50, don't be surprised if Manchin, Joe Manchin, conservative Democrat from West Virginia, switches parties. That would grant him more power. Think that's a possibility, Molly?
It's hard to imagine how Joe Manchin could have more power than he already does, right? I mean, look at the amount of influence that he had over the 50-50 Senate over the past 2 years. Some people described him as the real President Joe, right? I don't think and he's obviously had many opportunities, a lot of encouragement from the other side to make that switch. And he will eventually be up for re-election again. But I think it would have been much easier to imagine him potentially even being tempted to switch if Republicans had won the Senate, because then by switching, he would have had a shot at, you know, chairing committees. He would have been in the majority and be able to influence legislation in that way. At this point, you know, particularly if it's 50-50, every senator is the deciding vote, and nobody has maximized the potential of that, the leverage of that position more already than Joe Manchin.
Yeah,
so
great
point. I don't think that the 50-50 Senate incentivizes him anymore.
But one thing to speculate on, if the Democrats win Georgia, they will actually have one more vote than they did before, and that would mean they only need Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema, not both, to do things like abolish the filibuster. So how big a deal is Georgia or not, with control already assured?
It is a big deal for that reason, and also because it gives Schumer more power to write the rules of the Senate. So, you know, majority is a majority, but 51 seats is a much bigger majority than 50 seats, despite having the vice president's tie-breaking vote. So, but, you know, I think it's really early days in terms of even thinking about what this next Congress is going to do, simply because the results have not been what really anyone was expecting. And so they've sort of gone back to the drawing board. For example, there were a lot of things that Democrats assumed they were going to try to stuff into the lame duck session because they thought they were about to lose the majority. Now that that's not the case, there's potentially more time in the coming term to work on those kinds of issues.
Elizabeth Warren and maybe others are calling for an aggressive lame duck session now, that is from now till the end of the year before the new Congress takes over. Is there a chance to get something done now that they couldn't get done before the election?
Well, sure. And there are things that they have to get done. There's government funding, the debt ceiling's coming up, and various voices are calling for that to be abolished or taken off the table. There's other fiscal deadlines coming up. So they have to do some things in the lame duck. Whether they decide to go big in the lame duck, as you said, as Senator Warren is suggesting, I think it also depends on what happens in the House, because it appears all but inevitable that Republicans will take a very, very narrow majority in the House. But on the off chance that Democrats keep the House, then, you know, once again, it means that there's less need to pack things into the lame duck session. But if we assume that Republicans are going to take the House, that also throws a wrench into any grand plans that Democrats had for legislating. So we'll see. I think there's a lot of conversations going on right now, a lot of strategizing, and we're still waiting for these races to be called.
Right. So the House could go either way, a few seats one way or the other, for a tiny majority for one party or the other. Last thing I'll say is that even if the Republicans win the House and Biden can get very little through Congress and the Democrats and the Republicans can't get much through Congress, I think it's really important for Biden's ability to get his choice of federal judges confirmed for the next 2 years, Supreme Court on down, depending on openings, because he's got the Senate majority. Would you agree?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's potentially the most important aspect of keeping the Senate for the Democrats, because as we have seen in the sort of, you know, toxic and polarized climate of today's U.S. Senate, the opposing party doesn't give you anything. And so the Democrats have been very successful at making those appointments and getting those judges confirmed with a 50-50 Senate. And I think the administration breathed a sigh of relief seeing the Democrats keep the Senate primarily for that reason.
Molly Ball, national politics correspondent for Time Magazine. Thanks for starting us off, Molly. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.